Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
There's a picture of my mother striding down a street in 1938, impossibly elegant. She's wearing a tailored suit with a pencil slim skirt. A clutch bag is tucked under her arm, and topping it all is a jaunty hat. You can't beat a hat. It's all about the tilt of the hat, the tilt of the brim. If it's curled back to reveal the face, you can seem young and innocent. If it's dipping over one eye or low enough to shadow both eyes, you're mystery woman. Think Ava Gardner, Ingrid Bergman. My mother liked the bit of mystery. So do I. You can hide a lot behind a hat. I fell in love with hats when I was about 13. I had discovered in our dressing up trunk a boater hat like French schoolgirls wore. I fancied it, so I decided to wear it to Sunday Mass. As I came downstairs, my father spotted it and he burst out laughing. "Would you look at her in the old-fashioned hat," he said. So the hat was thrown back in my room. But I was bitten by the bug. Hats were theatrical. To my cousin's wedding, I wore a Dick Turpin hat with a swathe of black chiffon trailing down behind. One of the aunts was scandalised. "Black chiffon at a wedding," she sniffed. Oh yes, a hat gets you noticed. But for a hat that's really dramatic, go and look in the Patrick Pearse Museum in St. Enda's in Rathfarnham at a portrait by William Orpen of Beatrice Elvery. She was a daughter of the family who owned the sports shops, and she was a progressive artist and illustrator herself. She's painted wearing a black hat with a high crown and a great fan of blue and black feathers springing from it. All this laid on her mane of bright red hair. She looks like a very beautiful witch. She was also the model for the marble bust of Roisin Dubh in St. Stephen's Green, and her face was described by Patrick Pearse as an expression of the soul of Ireland. All these things she may have been, but by God, she was also a woman who could wear a hat. The difficulty for hat wearers these days is finding an occasion, the odd traditional wedding, or maybe the races. Years ago, we had Sunday morning church, where, weirdly, the women had to cover their heads and the men had to bear theirs. So all along the window ledges and the spare seats were rows and rows of men's hats. Up to 50 or 60 years ago, most men wore hats, and you can see it in any outdoor picture of political gatherings or funerals. Hats were big business for families like those of Fianna Fáil leader and Taoiseach Sean Lamass. His father and his grandfather were trained hatters. Indeed, Lamass himself was probably the most nattily dressed and hatted Irish politician of all time. Look him up. Spats and a hat. Mind you, the big danger with a hat is of ever letting it out of your hand. My favourite was a Borsellino. I had spotted it coming through the men's department in Galerie Lafayette in Paris. It was dark brown felt with a three-colour leather band. And when I tried it on, it was perfect. From every angle, it was perfect, except for the price. So sadly, I put it back. When I told my husband about it afterwards, he marched straight back in and bought it for me. I love that hat. I still wear it, but once I had to hand it into a cloakroom. "Would you put it up there on the high shelf?" I begged the attendant. When I came back to collect it, the hat couldn't be found. "They'd look for it," they said. As I pulled on my coat, I found something stuffed in the sleeve. There it was, all squashed up like a child's knitted beanie. "Ah, you found it," they said happily. I was speechless. I did my best, but it never recovered the distinctive dip of its brim. Lesson learned, keep your hat on. Wearing a hat takes attitude. It's not just about how you look, but about how you feel. The hat designer Philip Tracy knows all about that. This year, he was given a President's Distinguished Service Award, a recognition of members of the Irish diaspora and Friends of Ireland who've done the state or its reputation some service. So among the awardees were people who'd set up departments of Irish literature, who ran theatres featuring Irish dramatists, who had helped Irish immigrants, or who had stood up for human rights. Philip Tracy says simply that he makes hats and that they make people feel better. At the reception afterwards in the Oris for him and his fellow awardees, Philip was surrounded by his many brothers, tall County Galway men, well made as oak trees, with this fine silver birch, graceful to his fingertips, in their midst. You couldn't but be struck by the family resemblances and the family pride in the man who's been described by Vogue magazine as one of the greatest milliners in the world. Hats are about emotion, he says, and I like hats that make the heart beat faster. Boom, boom.
Our romance won't end on a sorrowful note, though by tomorrow you're gone. The song is ended, but as the songwriter wrote, the melody lingers on. They may take you from me. I'll miss your fun.
A Nobel laureate once said that if he was asked to place in a time capsule something to represent mankind's finest achievements on Earth, he would select a recording of Bach's St. Matthew Passion. That was the arresting opening line of a documentary I came upon one rainy afternoon flipping through channels in my Paris apartment some 25 years ago. That chance encounter ignited a love affair with Bach and with the Matthew Passion that has never left me. Indeed, if I were ever invited on Desert Island Discs and asked which of my 8 records I would cling to if the others were washed away, I would let Beethoven, Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and indeed the Beatles, Elton John and the Proclaimers take their chances in the waves as I hung on to Bach's great work. Bach was born on this day, 31st of March, in 1685. The Matthew Passion was written when he was about 40, and it's thought it was first performed on Good Friday 1727 at the Thomaskirche in Leipzig. The Passion is the most elaborate of all Bach's works, the culmination of his sacred music, and one of the towering achievements of all music, in my opinion. It was nevertheless essentially unknown for over a century, until in 1824, Felix Mendelssohn was given a copy of the music by his teacher, himself a devotee of Bach. Mendelssohn took a scalpel to the Passion, cutting out large swathes of the music to focus in on the narrative of the last hours of Christ, from his agony in the garden to the crucifixion. Revising the Passion took time, so it was not until 5 years later, in 1829, that the 20-year-old Mendelssohn conducted the first revival performance. Passion for the Passion, as it were, spread, albeit slowly, across Europe, with its first English performance in London, a full 25 years later, in 1854. Today, in secular and non-secular settings, it is heard around the world, particularly at Easter time. Why does it mean so much to so many? I can only speak for myself, although there's an excellent programme in the BBC's Soul Music series where a number of people describe why it matters to them. For me, it's partly the story it tells. A story of betrayal, suffering, sacrifice, but ultimately of hope. It's also nostalgia, for want of a better word, for the holy weeks of my Scottish Borders childhood. The Passion itself, the story of Christ's suffering and death, is central to those memories. The bare altar on Good Friday, the elderly priest shuffling around the stations of the cross, the tall, cold church in darkness at the start of the Easter Vigil. Then, of course, there is the music. Mind-blowing, breathtaking. It is so strikingly original, even now. so it must have fallen like a stunning storm of sound on the parishioners of Eisenach on that Good Friday afternoon 300 years ago. It unsettles but also inspires you, from the unconventional chord progressions in the opening chorus to the soaring drama of the closing one, memorably, if improbably, used by Martin Scorsese in his gangster epic Casino. But for many listeners, certainly for me, it's the simplest and shortest of the movements, a brief aria for solo voice and violin, which speaks most powerfully of all. Erbarme dich, mein Gott. Have mercy on me, my God, sings Peter, after he has denied Jesus three times. Just 17 words are needed to sum up one man's, every man's, lament. About a century before Bach, Caravaggio, also aged about 40, and in the last year of his turbulent life, had been inspired by the same gospel passage to create one of his great works, The Denial of St. Peter, which hangs in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. For 3 years I had the joy of living 10 minutes from that museum, and more than once stood before the Caravaggio, with the Bach aria playing in my head, and at least once in my headphones. The Matthew Passion has been an essential solace to me for more than half my adult life. For some it has been even more. The BBC's Soul Music episode I mentioned recounts the extraordinary experience of a young American musician at death's door in intensive care, whose life is saved after his girlfriend, believing him to be dying, plays some extracts from The Passion on her iPhone in order to say goodbye. Instead, within seconds of hearing the music, he starts to recover and lives, literally, to tell the tale. The Passion of Christ is, for Christians, the ultimate tale worth telling. Bach's account of it is, for me, one of the great achievements of European civilization. And when civilization, not just in Europe, is more than ever something not to be taken for granted, I'm more grateful than ever for the chance, which I had again in the National Concert Hall this week, to experience it.
I heard this story in segments from a woman I queued behind in the Radio Centre canteen in my first few days as a trainee producer in Donnybrook 40 years ago. When she turned from the counter till, she had the most beautiful blue eyes. You could see to the bottom of their sadness, like the wavering sandbed of a Mediterranean anchorage, all turquoise and moist. You have the most beautiful eyes, I said. I didn't mention the Mediterranean. Now, I was a student with Stubble, and she was close to retirement, but she didn't denounce me to human resources. This was still, thank God, the 20th century. Instead, we changed and exchanged a few words, and the styrofoam cup of black coffee burned my palm briefly while she dunked and hoisted her tea bag. Next time we met in the same canteen, I was a probationer. She was thinking pensions. What, she asked, was I working on? Well, I had found a photocopied typescript of a short play by Thomas Macdonagh, the revolutionary martyr of the 1916 Rising and former head of my own Department of English in University College Dublin. Admittedly, it was terrible, still. But it's not about insurrection, I said, or about resurrection. It's about reincarnation. His poor wife, she said. She walked into the sea shortly after. The woman with the beautiful blue eyes that emerged had been 20 years younger when the jubilee of the Easter Rising was celebrated at every statue in every square of the 26 counties. I was 10 at the time and remembered the two Spitfires flying low over O'Connell Street and the Bangartha who brought me to a barracks when I got lost among smelly trench coats at Nelson's Pillar. Blue Eyes would have been safe and settled in her own workspace, a tall box room off a grand corridor in the Henry Street headquarters of Radio Éireann, tucked in like a squashed shirt tail behind the GPO. It was Cosc and O'Haron breakfast, dinner and supper, she told me. That was right and proper. But I didn't mind being asked to do a My Fair Lady feature on the fly. The film was still running round the corner, and it just so happened that Stanley Holloway, who plays Eliza Doolittle's dad in the film, was staying at the Gresham. He's the dustman who sings, "Get me to the church on time." "I'm getting married in the morning," I sang. "Ding dong, the bells are going to chime," she said. So I looked up everything about him, all the other films he'd made that weren't famous, the old black and white ones that begin with a naked man banging a gong. I actually went round the corner to see My Fair Lady again. "I even read the play it's based on," she said, "George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, which is based in turn on a Greek myth about a person called Pygmalion, who turns into Professor Higgins in the play and into Rex Harrison, who can't actually sing a note in the musical." "Talk about reincarnation," I said. "When I met him, he was lovely," she told me. "Not at all the working man he was always cast as. Very dapper, very dignified. I had a dozen questions I was going to ask him, all typed out, and I let him see them before we started. It was smooth sailing. One take, no edits, in the can. He knew the business. He'd broadcast on the BBC during the Blitz, for God's sake. And then I walked him from the building and out the front door. Flags and bunting everywhere, and soldiers practicing their drill for the big day where the stand was being erected at the post office." "The story should be in the archives," I said. I'm sure it's in the Variety archives." She told me that the same Stanley Holloway had told her it was good to be back in Dublin. But that wasn't anywhere in the accordion folds of the station archives. He told her it was good to be back in Dublin 50 years later, half a hundred years after, almost to the week, almost to the Easter week of 1916 itself. That wasn't in the archives either. There was no mention on acetate or reel-to-reel of Holloway, the teenage subaltern in the Connacht Rangers who'd been pinned down under crossfire at a bridge over a river that might have been a canal, in the ricochet of chippings and the whiff of hot horse dung. And off he strode, the natty dresser with the military bearing, the flower seller's father, the coal man comic, into a seething Sackville Street, all open-back buses, duffel-coated students on bicycles with mudguards, and the beehive hairstyle of girls pushing hooded prams towards Lemon's Pure Sweets confectionery next door to the Metropole. I like to imagine that the fair lady with the beautiful eyes watched him disappear. Her turquoise iris must have moistened in the glare and diesel of a midday Dublin pavement. Then a colleague on his way to the Tower Bar clapped her on the shoulder and congratulated her in Irish on her coup. You needed an easy interlude, a respite from the rising, during the mayhem of this Jubilee month.
And girls all over London, and I've got to track them down in just a few more hours.
I'm getting married in the morning. Ding dong, the bells are gonna chime.
What's for supper? Oh, there's not much. I suppose we'll have to have eggs, said in a voice of apology. But there's nothing to apologise for. The egg, one of the most common items in our kitchens and found in cuisines all over the world, is actually a marvel beyond our reckoning. It is strong, beautiful, versatile. It symbolises the beginning of life, and it represents perhaps the most elegant piece of packaging in all of nature. You have to handle eggs carefully, as they're so easy to break, yeah? Well, just try this. Take an egg and pincer its two pointed ends between your thumb and finger. Now try and crack it. You'll be a long time trying. And if you halve an egg across its middle, the bottom half gives you the arch shape, which architects know is capable of bearing very heavy loads. Aside from that, it is pleasing to the eye. Nature once again shows she's unsurpassed in marrying engineering and aesthetics. The pleasing shape and the promise of good things inside is what inspired the Fabergé eggs, made one a year for the Russian royal family from 1883 to 1916. These exquisite objects now change hands for tens of millions of dollars. The first ever was the hen egg, enamelled and banded in gold, inside which was a golden yolk, which in turn opened to reveal a golden hen sitting on gold straw, and inside that hen a tiny replica of the imperial crown with diamonds and a ruby pendant. That's a far cry from the red jungle fowl that was domesticated in Southeast Asia around 8,000 years ago, and is the forebear of today's clucking hen, now found in every country but one, the Vatican. In ancient times in Ireland, hens and cocks were so much part of daily life that they were chosen as the standard from which early measurements were taken. The egg of a full-grown hen was taken to be 4 inches in circumference and 5 inches along the long axis. Halved, an eggshell was used to measure liquids, and as we all know, distance was measured by how far away a cock crow could be heard. In the 12th century poem, or Aisling, The Vision of Mac and Glinia, the poet describes eggs as the pearls of the household. And there is an old Irish saying translated as, the three sharpest things on earth, a hen's eye after grain, a blacksmith's eye after a nail, and an old woman's eye after her son's wife. Early law texts tell us that a hen typically laid up to 50 small eggs a year, the size probably that of a pullet or bantam egg. Quite often the Banuntee would keep her laying hens in the house, because in the warmth of the kitchen they knew nothing of the seasons and would continue to lay all year round. But whilst hens' eggs could be had all year round, other eggs were less reliably available. This very morning I took a single goose egg, its yolk the colour of buttercups, and made scrambled eggs enough for 2 people. When they're around, you need to make the most of goose eggs, though, as geese lay for only a few weeks of the year and are very secretive about where and when they lay. Eggs have long been close to the heart of the Irish woman, for by selling them or bartering them for sugar or tea, she helped out the household budget. Dorothy Hartley, an English traveller in the 1930s, was struck by the sight that met her eyes on market day in Galway. Dozens of jaunting cars, the country people pouring in, donkeys trot in bulky with panniers full of carrageen and dillisk, and by truck, lorry, bus and cart come eggs, 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 hundreds of eggs in big, deep baskets. Even the best housekeepers found that hens would lay fewer eggs in the winter time, so methods of preservation were devised, the main ones being water glass and butter. The water glass method dating back to the 1800s, uses a chemical, and I prefer the old technique of smearing the shell of a new-laid egg with warm butter, as this seals the holes in the porous shell and stops the contents from deteriorating. Worthy of celebrating every day of the year, the egg has a special significance at Easter. Chocolate eggs first appeared at the court of King Louis XIV, although the modern versions, depressingly, seem to arrive on supermarket shelves not long after Christmas. However, in many countries, people carry on the religious tradition of colouring and decorating eggs for the feast of Easter, often dyeing them red to symbolise the blood of Christ. However you think of an egg, one thing is sure, it is an archetypal symbol of life, birth, renewal, perfection, the pearl of the household.
On the plate. All the poems I write, I will put on this plate. The sun always warm on our raised and freckled faces. Easter of loss, a mother gone. I will put on the plate soft blossoms, pink and white, to fling onto her grave. And her hands. I will put on this plate her hands. How they thumbed its pastry rim, the apple's peel curled like bitter snakes. Then her fingers, on the sheets of her last day with us, how they twitched, then were stilled. All this I will put on the plate for you.
Leipzig, St. Matthew Passion. There is a storm tonight in Thomaskirche. Judas scuttles about, arms like claws reaching. At last, he embraces the quiet Lord and is embraced. The mobs, in chorus, agitated, rush like waves towards the shore and out again. I sit attending, back of the church, scarce seeing. My neck hurts, arthritis aging. I resist at first the music, eyes dry, belly taut. I have touched on grief before, its long, bleak alleyways. Sopranos, basses, so many ocean breakers wash busily amongst us, bearing high the poster of this wanted man. Do you know him? Do you recognize this man? Surely you are one of his disciples. What has he done, this man? He has been crying in the streets, on the lake shores, urging the needs of the poor and oppressed, asking the questions we do not want to hear. So let there be noise and chorus. And though the sea is washing over us, we who stand or sit do not drown. It is Bach, Prospero, and we are ticket holders. Under my feet there are shifting sands. To my left, an elegant granite column lifts into the darkness of distant rafters. Beyond, on the cliff, the seafarer Christ is on the road. Our music now is ended. Once more are we hopeful of calmer seas, auspicious gales. We have risen out of the wreck, and know we are again forgiven. We are such stuff as flotsam, and we are blessed to be cast up safe tonight on this city's shores. But, I ask, as we listened, were not our hearts on fire within us?
On this morning's programme, we heard You Can Keep Your Hat On by Olivia O'Leary, Passion for the Passion, Bach's St. Matthew Masterpiece by Paul Johnston, current British Ambassador to Ireland. Blue Eyes and Bell Chimes was by Aidan Matthews. The Pearl of the Household by Margaret Hickey. On the Plate, a poem by Enda Wiley. And Leipzig, St. Matthew Passion, a poem by John F. Dean. The music was They Can't Take That Away From Me, sung by Ella Fitzgerald. Erbarme Dich, Mein Gott, from Bach's St. Matthew Passion, sung by Judith Nemeth with the Hungarian State Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Geza Oberfrank. Get Me to the Church on Time, sung by Stanley Holloway and the My Fair Lady Ensemble. What Came First, The Egg or the Hen, by Willie Dixon, sung by Coco Taylor. And Spiegel am Spiegel by Arvo Pärt, featuring Nicola Benedetti on violin. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.